commission and having them make responsible decisions as to what that, that matrix should be. And therefore, the bill as it presently stands in, on page three is overly restrictive. Also, I think that that each commission member should be appointed rather than elected. The judges would be a poll of the judges. We would suggest that instead of a poll of the judges, that they be appointed by the Supreme Chief Judge of the Supreme Court, and also that instead of a poll of the district attorneys, that the Attorney General would appoint the district attorney. We think that an appointive process provides a more rational, if the intent is to provide a workable and rational solution through the appointive process, one would probably guarantee that better. Also, on page three, there's language that the court can simply disregard these matrix, this matrix, if they choose. If you have that kind of language, if you do not make it mandatory, you simply do not have anything new whatsoever, and you haven't begun to solve the overcrowding problem because the judges, on a uniform basis, could simply disregard it every time it it comes up. Also, on page three, there's some lip service played to taking into account prison resources. We think that it should be mandatory that the resources are taken into account. Otherwise, you've passed a bill that simply doesn't correct the problem, doesn't take into account the costs involved in the new system. As an alternative to this bill, if it's not passed, if it's perhaps regarded as too premature or not enough study has been directed to it, perhaps this legislature could establish a commission that would actually propose specific specific matrix, and the commission could also conduct research along the lines that the parole commission member was suggesting, and come back to the legislature in 85 and propose the specific package. In other words, you could take the bill and you could put it into effect and have the commission to formulate exactly how it would work and how it would influence the cost factors, whether it would become more overcrowded or less overcrowded. And that committee would then be in a workable form that could take off in 85 when the legislature met again. And along those lines, the Oregon Council on Crime and Delinquency has some specific proposals that we've prepared in a position paper that we would like to distribute and allow you to read at your leisure, that is very concerned with this. I think that one of the most significant things that the Oregon Council on Crime and Delinquency is concerned about is that if you pass the bill in its present form, it would simply be more lip service about the problem itself, and it wouldn't grapple with the problem because there isn't mandatory language in there in terms of what the judge is, what kind of guidelines the judge is restricted to. There are no guidelines or mandatory language that they must take into account the prison overcrowding or the resources, the limited resources. And so that the modifications are very important. Essentially, the Oregon Council on Crime and Delinquency is an organization primarily of lay people who are very concerned that the power of sentencing should come back to the judge, even in perhaps a limited form in which they only have a matrix in which to work with. At least it's better than having the parole commission make all the decisions. And also, the Oregon Council on Crime and Delinquency is very concerned about trying to grapple in trying to regulate the prison overcrowding in a way in which it can constantly be updated with a workable commission that can get back to the judges. And finally, it's just a matter of being honest with the general public. The present system is not honest with the general public. The only benefit that I can see in the Hargraves solution is that it is honest, at least, with the general public, and it really points to the disaster that we presently have.
For the record, I'm Michael Dane. I'm the executive director of the council. There's one other point I think that we should make in how we view the matrix, and that is that we think that the matrix also ought to address the issue of the in and out decision as to who goes in and who goes out, much akin to the Minnesota system. I think if you look at our correction system today and the way sentencing is done, you have to remember that right now there are about 14,000 people on probation and only about 3,400 in our institution. The decision to incarcerate or not incarcerate is, in most cases, the most significant decision to be made. If we deal only with the prison population, we're only dealing with a very small part of our sentencing. We're only dealing with a very proverbial tip of a very large iceberg. Additionally, if we don't have that kind of criteria available, one of the outcomes might be a virtual avalanche of commitments to county jails, because as is being used right now, a lot of judges are circumventing the matrix by simply sentencing felons to the county jail for a period of up to 1 year as a condition of probation, the balance of the time to be spent on probation. They feel that quite frequently, and I think they're right, quite frequently, the defendant will spend more time incarcerated than if put under the referral matrix. I see no reason for this philosophy to change unless we have some sort of regulation of the in-out decision as well.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Barnes, Mr. Bradley, are you here together?
Yes, sir.
Here's your kind of link on the sheet here.
First time
we've ever
been
to
this.
I was amused to see doing strange combinations.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Don Barnes. I'm a member of the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office, appearing today on behalf of the ACLU, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office, which provides defense services in Clackamas, Washington, and Multnomah counties. Mr. Bradley and I are here together because our positions in total opposition to the bill are essentially identical.
I'm John Bradley, representing the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office and also the Oregon District Attorney's Association. I think before I begin, I might want to say that our opposition, we may have opposition to the bill, but I don't know if it's going to be identical. They may be, you know, for some different reasons. I think I'd like to say a couple of things, and that is that I think that the problem we're talking about is really a population problem as far as the institutions go with the State Correctional Division. The fact that you have, what this appears, the bill before this committee seems to do, is to put the burden upon the trial judges. I mean, they're the ones that when you have the terrible case, well, we'll be sentencing someone to 3 or 4 years and people will expect 20-year sentences. Sometimes we refer to things as heat transfers. I don't know if it's fair to put the judges in that position, because it's not the judges that are responsible for funding and building larger institutions. I think that responsibility is either with the legislature or referral to the people, and I realize that was referred to the people. I've testified a number of times before this bill in the interim committee, and I would say that I think the favor that I have for this bill is the fact that you have disproportional sentencing among judges. And during the interim committee, I remember I said, and I still believe it, there were some people that testified that what someone got in Eastern Oregon differed from what someone got in Western Oregon. And I said, and I've testified, and I still believe that, is that that's not limited to just Oregon. It's also true of the courthouse. What somebody receives on the west end of the courthouse may be different than what someone receives on the east end of the courthouse. I mean, I've been a prosecutor now for over 12 years, and I know there's some judges that you take identical facts. There's some judges that will give probation for those facts, and there's some judges that will impose substantial penitentiary time for those facts. Judge Ari Jones, who now sits on the Supreme Court, I believe he testified during that interim committee. He said he had an example that he used to provide, I believe, to judges meeting, was it in Texas?
No, in Nevada.
In Nevada. And it was a death situation where somebody was killed, and he would give the fact situation, then he would ask the judges what sentences ought to be imposed. And he said that when he got the results, they went anywhere from probation to the death sentence for the, basically the same facts.
That's why we have juries.
I think juries are sometimes the same way, I mean, depending upon... I'm not saying, as I sit here as a prosecutor, I'm not saying that prosecutors don't vary also. You take the same fact situation in one county or another, or in the same county, again, they will differ. But the fact is that once a person is convicted and found guilty of a certain offense and there are certain situations, it seems that in a system that says we have equal justice, you do want sentences to be proportional, basically considering the person's background and considering the act. But that doesn't happen. And that's, looking at the bill in a favorable sense, I think that's a very, very favorable thing with the bill. The District Attorneys Association and our office, obviously, our greatest objections with this bill are on page 3 when they talk about basically the adding only 15% for aggravating factors if you're talking about two or more crimes. The most infamous case out of our county would be the Colin Hawkins case some years ago, where Mr. Hawkins was convicted of going in and killing four people, two children and two adults. If I read the statute correctly, that Mr. Hawkins in that situation, you're only talking about a slight increase, and perhaps I'm reading it incorrectly, but I think what Mr. Gary said about the fact that right now you could give consecutive sentences and consecutive matrices, and I think that's far more appropriate. And if some judge does something inappropriate, you always have the parole board having the ability to override those. The other objection that we have is the Section 8, and that talks about the pre-sentence investigation and also basically the hearing. In our office, about 4 years ago, we had somewhere between 65 and 67 lawyers. Today, we effectively have 49, and that includes the district attorney himself. Basically, what Section Number 8, which if you had 100 deputies and you had a lot of resources in the system, Number 8 might be just a wonderful system. But the trouble is it says that you have a pre-sentence report. If the defendant disagrees with the pre-sentence report, then you have an evidentiary hearing. And in Multnomah County, we have, I think if you talk to members of the parole board, the number of people sent to the penitentiary from Multnomah County, I think it numbers about half the total. I may be incorrect about that, but I'm sure you've heard figures about that. Well, for most of those people being sent to the penitentiary, you're talking about evidentiary hearings then. The other thing we're doing right now is we have pre-sentence reports. Generally, in a pre-sentence report, the defendant will sit down and talk about his life or her life. With the elimination, with saying that the defendant can contest everything in the pre-sentence report, this section may very well gut the whole idea of the pre-sentence report. Because most defense attorneys, when they think that their client may say things that will amount to aggravating factors, will in most probability tell their clients not to say anything. And as a result, I think the evidentiary hearing will become much greater. And the cost that Mr. Jones talks about, I think, is a realistic thing. And I think it's a realistic thing at the trial level. And I guess I'm not only talking about time of the district attorney's office, I'm talking about court time. I'm also talking about further time by defense attorneys. There have been some comments about the parole board, and I think the one thing about the parole board, it is a heat transfer mechanism right now, and it's been that way for some years, in the sense that where someone has to be paroled early because of population problems, and that's what we sometimes use the parole board for, the criticism generally goes to the parole board, not to the courts and not to the legislature. The one good thing about the parole board is it is a consistent board. When you're talking about 50 or 100 different judges throughout the state giving sentences, at least you have a parole board, one consistent parole board that sets sentencings as far as how long people will actually remain in custody, you do have a need for one central, basically a clearinghouse to ensure some equal justice. I think the talking about the pre-sentence reports in Section 9, I don't think there's anything wrong with that as far as the District Attorney Association goes. You also have, as Mr. Gary pointed out, the wedge problem. If you have the judge making certain facts under the wedge case, even, and I believe I testified to this several times before the Interim Committee, as I said, that you really, all of a sudden, you may have substantial constitutional problems, and these substantial constitutional problems will not surface for 8, 9, 10, 12, 15 months. And in that period of time, you're going to have a lot of sentencings that if there is, in fact, a wedge problem, it's going to be hundreds of cases that will have to come back and have rehearings or perhaps jury trials. And I think that I don't have anything further unless there are any questions.
Questions?
Don, did you have anything to add to that?
Very briefly. I think the problem with the constitutional issue has been sufficiently raised to point out the fact that there's an apparent disaster looming a year from now under Wedge, Quinn, and the doctrine of the separation of powers if this bill, in fact, passes. A great deal of the impetus for the bill has been honesty in sentencing. Certainly a great deal more important than honesty in sentencing in the sense in which it's used here is fairness in sentencing. It appears now that with the parole board we have, working with the very excellent matrix system which they, together with a number of judges, have developed, do provide about the greatest degree of essential fairness in sentencing one can get. In other words, they diminish disparity of sentencing down to the point that people are objectively treated in our correction system. Because of that, we certainly urge retaining the parole board with its present functions and present powers. One thing I think that hasn't been adequately addressed here is the pragmatic problem that we're going to have, given the framework of economic and logistical limitations in which the court and the court system and bar would be working. There's dissatisfaction with a minimum of 80% of the pre-sentence reports in felony cases in our office, which I'm sure is pretty representative because we handle a significant number percentage of the state's cases. To have that number of hearings would virtually collapse an already relatively ineffective court system. We have criminal cases on call now reported ready for 12, 14, 19, 20, 21 days in a row, with witnesses having to be controlled by either side, with all the kinds of logistical problems that brings. Our court system simply cannot handle the massive number of prolonged evidentiary hearings which would result from this. As far as provision of legal services is concerned, the District Attorney's Office, at least in Multnomah County now, I would submit with all respect to Mr. Bradley, is so underfunded that they can't provide basic protection to the public. This is true by virtue of the selective system that goes on, the nature of cases we see that are now prosecuted are with much greater quantitative and qualitative amount of prosecuting evidence. Other cases are simply not brought into the system. This is an incredible fraud on the public. I understand that they're now considering whether or not, in fact, even to consider prosecution of misdemeanors based on a forthcoming budget cut. Pragmatically speaking, our system can't afford the incredible luxury of long, drawn-out evidentiary hearings in every sentencing situation, which are unnecessary because of what I would submit as a basic record of fundamental fairness and leveling as a result of the excellent job the parole board has done. I know it's very fashionable to criticize the parole board because they're always releasing too many people from prison, but you have to remember they're always keeping the prison full, too. So we're dealing with finite resources, and the system simply can't stand this additional load.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you both for coming. Our final one is Mr. Chambers.
Let's put it together.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, and the Chamber's executive decision. The administrator, Mr. Watson, was asked by the committee to be present this afternoon to answer questions the committee might have concerning the impact of bills under consideration. He was unable to be here. He asked me to be present. Specifically, to House Bill 2087, the Corrections Division has no position for or against. We have frankly been unable to make any clear assessment of the bed space impact the bill might have. We do note that judges have repeatedly shown dismay over the length of terms established by the parole board as being too short. We very seldom hear a judge claim dismay because the terms established are too long.
You know, could you speak up a little bit or move the mic closer to you? I think we'll public hearing you.
We therefore feel that in all probability, the commission established in the manner described by the bill would establish terms longer than those, a matrix which would establish terms longer than those currently experienced. We would note that the average set by the board over the last 14 months has been just at 24 months. It's never excluded. A one-month increase in average length of stay would result ultimately in the additional 165 beds. 2 months would be twice that, with concomitant costs in both construction and subsequent operation on the
Okay, Neil, as long as you're there, we'll just turn the pages for a minute and you won't have to come back up. You have an analysis on the other three bills.
Sure.
2267 indicates you could not make a reasonable assessment of impact without extensive research.
On 2267, we find out that if the bill were to generate five additional category six terms each month, that would probably result in 140 additional beds sometime up the line. The first impact of such behavior wouldn't be felt for about 35 months, sometime in the fall of 1986. And they would take somewhere in the vicinity of 1998 before you have final impact. But that's simply one example. Five new category six terms imposed to a present matrix. Give you some example.
Okay, in 2268, as you indicated, would really depend on whether there are judges who are withholding consecutive sentencing now under some impression that they do not have that power.
We've seen no evidence
where
of that for our interest.
And then 2896.
Could you mark that in the record, please?
You might wish it were the case, is that right?
House Bill 2896 would have no impact at all for these 12 months. There would potentially be some increase in prison bed space thereafter, but we wouldn't know how much for a total of about 23 years. The problem here is that currently a person completing his or her term is discharged from supervision. The only way to then return to prison would be by conviction of a felony. Whereas under provisions of 2896, if the person had originally been convicted of two counts, which were separable, the person would then be at risk for an additional at least 5 and possibly 6 years for return to or for placement in prison for behaviors that were essentially non-criminal, but simply repetitive to the point the judge runs out of ideas.
Questions? Thank you. We appreciate, as always, the effort of the division to try to help us assess institutional impact.
I think we all need a 3 or 4 minute stretch before we take the other bills. As we bring people up for the other bills, those of you who are signed on more than one of the three, I'll ask you, if you will, to plan to comment on all three, so we don't need to drag you back.
What's the time frame look like on it, Mr. Chairman?
Oh, I would guess another, I would think half hour or so. Let's take about,
yeah. Representative Scudero and I are looking forward to a long evening this evening at another committee, so we're...
You know, the meetings, right?
Yes.
Let's just take about a 5 minute stretch. 15 minutes before your other committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'm there yet. But we're at a public hearing only on 2087, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's enough problem with 2087 that before the committee would spend a lot more time processing it, I think we ought to poll the committee and see if there's any real interest in going any farther with it.
Well, Representative Smith, the 2087, I think I'd like to get the full committee here. Whether or not we go in the direction of 2087 as it's now introduced, it would be my intention to use 2087 as a vehicle, perhaps an omnibus vehicle, for any other changes we might want to make. And perhaps there are portions of 2087 as now introduced that may survive the work of the committee. I just can't say yet. But I understand what you're saying, but I would rather just defer for now any judgments.
Well, I think we finished with it for today, but I...
Yeah. But I would, to the extent we can, like to try to develop an omnibus bill dealing with the entire structure that we're addressing here. And we're gonna be taking bites out of that structure as we go along, as far as the number of bills we consider, and I'm trying to organize them by related subject area. But when we get done with the process, I think, to the extent possible, I'd like to aggregate everything into a single bill. Okay, let's move now to the hearing on the other three bills. And as I indicated, if you have comment on more than one of the bills, if you'd like to give us that as you come up, I think that'll expedite matters.
Let's take, maybe we can just have the audience go this way or that way as we call the numbers up.
Let's consider all three bills before us, although 2267 is the first bill listed, but let's see. Judge Hargraves?
Mr. Chair, I just distributed to the committee the fiscal impact statements on 2087, 2267, and 2268.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jim Hargraves, Circuit Judge in Lane County. I'd like to very briefly address 2267 and 2896. 2267, I'm really not here to take a position for or against the bill. What I'm here to address is the language in subsections 2 and subsections 3 and point out what I think to be some difficulties that may need some further thought, because I think it doesn't clearly address the problem. If you look at subsection 2 in 2267, it says, when the same conduct or criminal episode, though violating only one statutory provision, involves two or more victims, there are as many separate punishable offenses as there are victims. There may be some very clear applications of this, but for instance, consider, does this mean that if my house is burglarized and my wife and I are owners of that house, does that mean we have two burglaries instead of one? That's certainly a way to read that particular language, and I can feel quite certain, at least in Lane County, we'll be dealing with that issue from the defense lawyers and the prosecutors. Same thing as if you steal my car that's in two names, or suppose someone steals 100 cars from Souther Spaulding et al. In Portland. Have you got 150 crimes? You do under the language literally read in subsection 2, I fear, and I think that there needs to be some additional thought that goes into that in defining this. Otherwise, we are going to be right back in the same problem area that we are now with the court trying to define when we have multiple crimes and when we don't. As I say, I'm not here to take a position one way or other of what ought to be the law, only that I think you ought to take a look at that. Subsection 3...
Can I ask a question about that, Judge?
Oh, certainly.
Representative Smith? I think we had this in our subcommittee this summer. I'm wondering, is that the same situation that the Attorney General brought to us, that when an airplane is blown out of the sky and there are 150 victims, but there's really only one statutory offense? The other side of what you're bringing to us is that should that be but one crime?
Well, certainly that's part of the same problem. It may be easy to say that if you plant one bomb and kill 100 people, we're going to make a choice that those are all separate offenses, and that would be clearly covered, I think, under your language in subsection 2.
But it goes too far.
But it goes too far because you then get into the area that I propose, really, how to define a victim.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I see your problem coming, is in defining what a victim is.
Representative Springer?
Would it be useful, just for a starting point, I think this reflects back on our conversation during the interim as well, to distinguish crimes against people versus crimes against property?
That's certainly one way to approach the problem. Again, I'm not really prepared to offer you any hot...